library from 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. And what you would be doing is working with fifth graders. They're looking for volunteers. I guess I forgot to mention that part. But we're looking for volunteers. We need to get a background check done on you because it's an elementary school. So I've got a form I can link you to that you'll need to fill out in the next couple weeks. But after that, you'll be working with probably two groups of 2 to 3 kids that'll be working on building a fully functional robot that Saturday. And we may even be having some training sessions ahead of time. I think the programming is real easy to most of the folks in this room, but knowing how the techniques blocks work in the Legos kit so that you can nudge the kid in the right direction to build the robot would be useful. So if that's interesting to you, let me know. And then Raleigh RB's next meeting, which I think is this coming Tuesday, it might be the following Tuesday here, is real interesting. They're talking about closure for Raleigh, not with a S, with a J. That's the new Lisp derivative that runs entirely on the JVM. They're going to be doing an introduction on that. And so you don't need to know Ruby to come to that one. It's going to be an entirely introduction topic. So that's what I've got for community announcements. Anybody else get inspired?
Someone may know this better than I do. There's a FOSS Fair sponsored by NC State February 12th. That's after the next trilogue meeting, so I'll remind folks. But I understand, on State Campus, I understand that they're looking for folks to present on something FOSS-oriented. If you have something you want to talk about, come on up. I've got flyers, too. I can email you and or you can Google it, I'm sure. Thanks.
You got flyers on with you?
I'm in a PDF email form.
Okay.
And that has just been sent to our mailing list as well.
Oh. Yeah, it just appeared on the mailing list, and as I skim the keywords here, they mentioned that it's kind of Barcamp-like, and so it might be really easy to get in as a presenter if you got anything interesting to say. That'd be awesome. Bring your resume, is that what you said? Looks good. Okay. Presented at FOSS Fair. On the radar of those kind of things, keep in mind CarolinaCon's at the end of April and Maker Faire is June 18th. And then where's the rest of our agenda? I'm changing too many windows here. All right, so any additional community announcements? I am going to turn this over to Jim in a second to talk about the current state and future state of Trilog. But before we do that, I want to mention or ask how many of you are members in Trilog? Okay, cool. So I'm speaking to very few of you here when I say do not be shy about coming forward and asking for a membership form. All you have to do is fill out a few simple fields, and we will give you at the next meeting a very awesome membership card, which, among other things, will give you voting privileges. And this might be valuable to what you're about to hear from Jim, but it also gets you a discount at Intrex and a couple other cool things, like a shell account. So, Jim?
Thank you, sir.
Okay. I guess you could call this a State of Trilog speech. Anyway, 10 years ago, Trilog started operating as a North Carolina nonprofit corporation in order to accept hardware and monetary donations, and in turn redonating to schools and local lugs, acting as an incubator for promoting Linux. Over time, Linux has become more mainstream. It's accepted in the business world and even used at schools. Trilog's mission has therefore changed accordingly to become more of an educational and social group for technology and open source. Although we're still devoted to education and outreach, our income and expenses are now related to pizza and meetings. We are run by a steering committee whose membership changes by vote every year in May. The committee is a group of volunteers, which mean the committee members have a significant...
Yes. Raise your hands, volunteers.
Oh, yeah, okay. This committee is a group of volunteers, and that means that us committee members and the future committee members, past committee members, have a significantly limited amount of time and energy to invest in running Trilog. These two facts have led to a problem that Trilog now faces. Over time, the steering committee has focused its efforts on finding meeting speakers, donors, sponsors, and pizza, and maintaining our online resources. The annual steering committee handoffs and corporate bureaucratic tasks have taken a backseat to the point that we have been delinquent in our corporate paperwork and with our tax filings. In fact, we are just a hair's breadth away from losing our North Carolina nonprofit status and our federal EIN. So now we are faced with a decision upon which we must vote. We must choose between one of two options. Do we want to keep the nonprofit corporate status, which we've really not used nor needed as of late? If we choose this option, it means that we must, and I repeat, must, spend the time and energy, and possibly even money, required to dig ourselves out of a deep paperwork hole in order to prove to the IRS and the state of North Carolina that we desire and deserve to keep the nonprofit status. In order for this option to function, we must have volunteers other than the current steering committee who will stand up to do the necessary backlog work. In addition, our future steering committees must be responsible for the tasks necessary for maintaining the nonprofit corporate status. On the other hand, do we opt to dissolve Trilog as a corporation and become an informal user group handling money for pizza and speakers by using a DBA bank account doing business as Trilog? This choice allows our current and future steering committees to focus on providing speakers and pizza for meetings and maintaining our online resources. It also frees us from worrying about meeting or failing to meet corporate status requirements and performing the bureaucratic tasks necessary to maintain a nonprofit corporation. As you consider the two choices, keep in mind that Trilog has no current need for nonprofit corporate status, and that if we dissolve the corporation, at any time in the future we decide we need it, we can do what is necessary then to reincorporate. Also, consider that at the organizational meeting held in December, I don't know how many of you were there, but we had an organizational meeting in December to discuss basically our current status and what our options might be. When we discussed the matters, the opinion of the majority of those attending was that we no longer need to be a corporation, and it is imperative that those who choose this must stand up and invest themselves in making it happen, or the choice will fail. So we get a chance to vote and determine our future. Yes?
To be fair, that was the recommendation of most of the people who bothered showing up to the meeting that was only about that topic. I was almost the only voice in the room arguing for continuing forward with the nonprofit.
Right. Well, that's what he did say at the end of the statement. However, I did have a question to go with that.
Sure.
And those are things that we should discuss.
I'm going to address that in a very terse manner, which is this is not the meeting at which to discuss that. The meeting to discuss that was in December, and the further meeting to discuss that is convened on the mailing list. So we can continue this in as long of a thread as is necessary to get it all out on the mailing list. And we will have... Yeah, no, we're not being asked to make a decision tonight. We are going to vote on this in February. And if you believe that we should move forward with reinstating our nonprofit status and jumping through the hoops we need to do with the federal government to get our 501c3 classification back, I think one of the best ways to do that is to convince your fellow LUG members of the interest in whatever it is you want to lead that would benefit from having a nonprofit status. And we'll discuss that on the mailing list, and if you've got great ideas, we'll even talk about how it would benefit under nonprofit and how it wouldn't. But one of the key things we want here is to know who's actually willing to take the ball and run with something besides just getting great speakers and having yummy pizza at meetings.
Or not so great speakers.
Or great speakers. You can underwow us in a second.
Okay. And I'd like to point out something. If anybody is actually interested in what happened at the meeting in December, the entire meeting was recorded, and it was 2 hours plus.
It was nearly 3 hours.
Yeah.
But it also,
if you want to listen to it, it's there.
Participation from Jerry Glogie, who helped found Trilog back in 1999. She dialed in from the West Coast and had some great insight. So it's kind of a long 3 hours, but it is worth a listen.
And she's also the one who is legally responsible for maintaining the lug status.
And before I put this issue to bed for the day and say pick it back up on the mailing list, I want to mention that at 6:11 p.m. today, we got, as a steering committee, an email from whoever's currently responsible for the Novell Users Group. Has anyone here heard of the Novell Users Group? All right, one person. It's been inactive for 2 years, which is probably why there were so few hands. They are a nonprofit and are dissolving and have assets that they want to give away, because that is one of the things you have to do when you dissolve a nonprofit in the state of North Carolina, is give your assets either to the state or to other nonprofits that you deem worthy. They want to give half of it to Purple Elephant, which restores computers and gives them to the needy, and they want to give half of it to Trilog, which comes out to $3,500. So there is something at stake here in terms of if we actually were able to get our classification back in time to receive that, then we have something to work with immediately thereupon, and even money to help pay the attorney that we just hired to get us through the whole situation. So, yeah. So I look forward to a good discussion on the mailing list on that. Apologize that we don't have more time for it here, but hopefully Alan will entertain us greatly.
This one doesn't work all that well.
Okay, I can turn it off.
So, okay.
Probably more convenient for
you. Yeah. Sure. The question is, what status do we have if we choose not to maintain our corporate status and as a nonprofit, a North Carolina nonprofit corporation? We would be an informal club that would be ruled by a set of bylaws, which would be basically an exact copy of what our current articles of incorporation say. So we would still follow the same rules. It would be managed basically the same way, but without the burden of having to file taxes. We're currently run by volunteers who, out of the goodness of our heart, decided we want to devote a year to running the lug. It would basically be the same thing. Except no one would be on the hook for doing things like the administrative filings and stuff like that. Does that answer your question? So there's a little bit of background information that was on, that was posted to the mailing list at our November meeting right before we had our December organization meeting. It's actually on the main trilog.org webpage that mentions, it's a similar blurb that talks about sort of how the history of how we've sort of changed our direction. And then I guess Jim can post the thing that he read out tonight as well, so everybody can see that. So I guess moving on to the main part of the presentation, if there's no other questions about that. Part of being on the steering committee is finding great speakers, and if you can't find great speakers, then sometimes you just pull something out of your back pocket and you be a speaker yourself. So that's what I did. I'm recycling an old presentation that I saw at Trilog in 2005. I thought it was pretty cool, updated it a little bit, played with it, made some notes. And so what we're going to see tonight, if I can figure out how to get the dual display to work, is Device Mapper, and three facilities that use Device Mapper, RAID, Logical Volume Manager, and Lux. wow, that's like magic. I can't see any of that here. So so what is Device Mapper? Early on when these guys were throwing together things like RAID and crypto file systems and block devices that did interesting things, they found that a lot of these facilities were doing the same sort of thing. You wanted to provide a block device that you could put a file system on, and you wanted to talk to a block device that was actually a disk, and you wanted to do something in between it. And in the case of RAID and LVM, you wanted to just sort of jiggle around where the things are on the disk. And in the case of encryption, you wanted to use some sort of key or something to scramble the content in between what you've presented to the user and what you're actually reading off the disk. They found that these things were doing very similar sorts of jobs. So they came up with a kernel module called the Device Mapper, which does just that. It's got an interface on the top that's presented as just some device, an interface on the bottom that would be mapped to an actual drive, and somewhere in the middle you have some sort of hooks that run some sort of special sauce. So, yeah, this is going to be distracting. I'm looking at page one over here and page two over there. So one thing, if you want to play around with any of the stuff that we're talking about here, it can be real cumbersome to go, you know, grab an old PC and put five disks in it to play with RAID. So instead, what we're going to do is we're going to do a trick where we create a block device that you can mess around with. And you can make them really small so it doesn't take a lot of time to sync up or things like that. So what I'm doing is using this command called lo setup to create what they call a loop device. And so this is a clever little command. It's the dd command that normally you use to just fill up an area full of zeros or something like that, or to do a bulk byte-by-byte copy. But this is the clever bit that I stole from the presentation before mine, where they wanted a 1 gig file, but rather than waiting for it to fill up 1 gig worth of zeros, instead they just say, well, really only write 1 megabyte worth of zeros, but skip 1023 of those and actually only write it at the very end. So what you end up with, don't they call that a sparse file, where they actually it only uses up 1 meg of the disk, but if you did a LS, you'd see a 1 gig file. Now eventually, of course, you have to pay for that. If you actually fill it up with content, it will eventually take blocks off the disk and to store your data in. But to begin with, it means this command right here is almost instant, no matter how big of a device file that you want to create. So what I've done is I've just created a file in my current directory called disk1. It's just a normal file. There's nothing special about it. It's not a device. It's nothing like that. And if you run this command lo setup, what it does is it says create a loop device and map it. Actually, anything that you write to that loop device as if it were a disk, just actually write the contents into that file. So it's a nice way to play with these kind of facilities without having to dig, you know, different partitions or go grab 10 thumb drives and plug them in or something like that. It's just kind of nonsense, craziness. And you can do lo setup minus a, and it will list out your devices. So here it shows, you know, the one that I just created. And if you want to delete it, you can lo setup minus d, and it will get rid of it. Or it will unmap this loop one from that file, but the file will remain on your disk. Is that clear? Because we're going to use this a couple of times. All the rest of the slides actually refer to dev loop one, loop two, loop three instead of disks.
What's the benefit of setting up the loop back device instead of displaying the disk one file?
The disk one file is a file. The dev loop one is a block device. It's actually, you could do a make file system on dev loop one, and it would look just like it did if it were a disk. Or you could do a F disk on dev loop one and actually put partitions in it, actually make it look like a real, as far as the OS is concerned, it looks just like a physical disk.
The LO setup creating the dev loop one, or is the loop one something that is recreated?
I believe it creates the loop one. Is that right? Okay. So older systems would have it there, newer systems would create it on demand. So I'll be honest with you, I don't know a whole lot about software RAID. I have used it at work. I stole most of the content of these slides, but I do know a whole lot more about LVM and Lux. But I figured they all go together so well, I'm just going to slide right through it and do my little tap dance, and I'll let you guys kind of fill in the bits that I don't know. So it's funny, anytime you talk about RAID, the first thing somebody says is, oh yeah, I use that for backup. And it just makes me cringe every time I hear it. RAID is not backup. RAID is for a system that cannot tolerate the amount of being down for the amount of time it would take to replace a disk. If you want to be able to keep a system up and running and replace a disk at the same time, then RAID is for you. If you don't need to do that, then RAID is overkill. Now, that being said, the place where I work at Tekelec, we install systems in telecom situations like you know, all the AT&T, Verizon, all the different carriers, T-Mobile, all those guys. And they have some systems that they want to keep up and running. But then during a maintenance window, they'll actually use RAID as if it were a backup. They'll take a mirrored drive and they'll stop using the RAID facility so that one part of the mirror just remains unchanged. They'll run all their upgrades on the second part of the mirror, and they run it, and they see if it works right. And if it did, and if everything worked okay, they tell it to start RAID back up with this as the master to copy all the new stuff over to the old drive. And if it didn't work, they start RAID up with this as the master, and all the old stuff gets copied over to the other drive. So that's kind of a clever way to do it, and you could say, in a way, it's a little bit like a backup, but not really. In this case, the main reason they do that is because of the amount of time you want to be down. You want to bring the system back up very quickly, figure out whether it's sane or not, and then you don't have any more downtime while it's copying blocks from the good disk to the bad disk, or the one that's just now coming online. I am going to teach you about LVM snapshots because those are really cool.
One other thing you might use RAID for is RAID 0 strengthened.
That's right. So right here, the different RAID levels, and I dug this straight out of Wikipedia because every time you talk about RAID, somebody else comes along and says, oh, well, no, I actually use RAID 15 plus. What is that? Well, that's like a 1 with a 5 with plus something. And I never understand what they're talking about. It's like, there's so many different levels and 10 and 1 plus 0 and all that, whatever. But the way I remember it is 0 is round, and that's like something spinning really fast. So that's striping disks, which give you your bits really fast. That's right. 1 is flat, and it looks like a mirror. So it's mirroring. It's basically two disks with the same information on it. And then there's some other variations. I'll let you peruse these at your own leisure. When you set up, LO set up with some loop devices, you can tinker with them and figure out what makes them tick. But there's basically one command that you need to know. It's this mbadm, and it does all the magic setup. It creates a file, I believe, mbadm.conf. Does that sound right? And it has entries in it that say, these are the disks that I define, and these are the arrays that of the disks that make up the arrays. So it has all the information about what disks go together. There are, you basically use a command like this with C for create. You're creating a device called MD and some number. So multi-disk array number 1, or number 0, I guess, is the one we're creating. It's array level 5. And then you give it the list of devices. So I've got 3 devices in this array. I have not tried these examples to see that they actually work right. I have tried the LVM ones, but there was a note that you can actually put the word missing in here as one of the drives because you may be defining an array where you don't actually have the parity drive or something like that, and you're trying to rebuild a parity drive. You're trying to put a brand new drive into an array. And then there are some steps missing. There should be like FDisk and stuff like that, or in a, you know, make file system and all that stuff. But if you had array to array already set up, maybe you had some, you're rebuilding a system, such as 2 years ago our server Pilot went down and we had to rebuild it. Was that 2 years ago already? And this is one of the things that we had to do, is just to, we knew what disks were there. We had to just tell it, these are part of your array, now go mount it and all that. But the point is, once you've set up your MD0, it's then the disk that you're treating just like you would SDA1 or something like that that you're used to. So this is the part where I'm going to dance a little bit. One of the jobs that I had at Tekelec was to work on the scripts that we used that actually did this from a higher level, so that our technicians never had to play with these commands directly. So we had these things called fail disk, and you'd tell it which disk you wanted to fail to be able to remove it. But deep down in the guts of that, what it would basically call is this MDABM command, and it would give a remove with a remove option to say remove this from the array. You can add them back, and here you can actually tell it to simulate what would happen if a one device in the array failed. Does anybody have some words of wisdom they'd like to share with us about MDABM?
Well, Jim, I don't believe electric your hardware is closed. I don't believe it's getting that drive out of the system and put a new one in, like hardware away.
It depends. If it were a USB drive, you could just unplug it. Okay.
Yeah.
So if you've got one where smoke is coming out of it already, you would mark it as failed, and then, or you would delete it.
You
would remove it.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't get all bent out of shape when you try to do the remove. Pull it out, put a new drive in. Right. The whole time it's live. So this could be your root file system that you're actually sitting on at the time. One interesting thing is, when you do this, be sure you remove the right drive. On our system, there was no indication on which one it was.
Point of experience also, don't trust your motherboard's documentation, because what the drives are what they say they are. Happened to us. Said SDA on the board, that was not that drive.
Dev node name?
Yeah.
SD whatever name, you can never trust them. You want some kind of persistent naming, you need to write your own UDEV rules that you're talking about.
That is correct. In fact, that's what I was doing at Tekelec, was to change the logic so that we don't rely on the fact that SDA is going to be this one and SDB is going to be this one, because now those things are, as the kernel boots up, they're in whatever order they're detected, they're assigned a drive letter. And the next time you boot it up, it might be just SDB and SDC, just because the SCSI layer has decided it wanted to do that. And Linus himself, that's one of his little pet peeves about this whole that whole subsystem, was if you really want to know which drive you're talking about, use UUIDs assigned to a particular piece of hardware. There you go. Very well put.
So if you're doing this with real disks instead of loop 1 and loop 2, you probably have SDB and SDC. So what we're getting at here is you would fail, let's say SDC is having problems, you'd fail /dev/SDC and then -r/dev/SDC. And the sanity check would, you look at the activity light and then put your hand on it. Actually writing, because if you're using the whole disk as one of your things, if you take it out, about MDADM is probably not going to have any activity anymore.
So, yeah, we actually ran into problems when one of the ways that we would initially install software on some of these blades that we run in these phone company situations is you take a USB stick and you go plug it in to the blade. And a lot of times you'd just leave it down in the lab. You'd go write something to the USB stick, and then you say, all right, now go install your software from the USB stick. And you don't even remember that it's plugged in. It's been a month since you've even been down in the lab. And then you go do one of these tests over here, and then when it comes back up, well, SDA is now the USB stick, and SDB and SDC are now the two drives that used to be A and B the last time you booted. So, you know, hilarity ensues, I believe, is what they say after that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then there's no, the UUIDs for device. MDADM.com. And there's also /proc/MDstat. I forgot to mention that one. That one is the one that will tell you the status of all the drives in your array, whether they're rebuilding. Is that the one that shows you the little percentage of how much is rebuilding? Nice.
You'll come up into the greatest status on RAID 5 too on the crate. So you'll see a rebuild in a micro device.
Right.
Not a bad IOA for
that. Yeah, that's the other thing that's kind of interesting. You know, you'll be running along just like normal, but if you look, blocks are just copying like crazy because it's got a whole disk over here that it has to fill up with the stuff that's on the other disks. But it's kind of funny, you don't really notice it unless you're looking at your IO or if you're doing something that's kind of IO intensive. So it's really kind of cool. In fact, on the systems that we used at Tekelec, we actually had hardware RAID controllers, but we just used them for a controller that happens to be able to have two drives on it that are hot swappable. We chose not to use the hardware RAID because the software RAID is so much more flexible. I can put, you know, if I take a 500 gig drive out, but I have a 640 gig drive I want to put in, no problem, whatever. It will use, you know, the first 500 gig of that drive, where some hardware controllers are extremely picky about having drives match and all that.
Yes, could you go into that scenario briefly? If you actually had the hot swap hardware, you would, I guess, if one of those drives failed, you would then fail and then lose it.
I think you'd do the fail, and then you do the dash R remove, take it out, put a new drive in there. Once you find out what letter it is or UUID or whatever, you'd call the dash add to add it back. And as soon as you add it, it'll start syncing up. Did we ever, so you guys over there don't see that the next slide is actually about spares. Thanks. So it says spares can be specified when the array is created using the spare devices equals n option. And here was just an example of that. And then you can even add them later, you know, after you've already built the array. So you see its lineage there from the older system.
Well, at least just from a pattern. The other thing is, I'm familiar with an MDSTAT, which also displays a lot of the same thing you were just talking about with flash proc. So if you were to switch a
buyers are actively thinking at the time, which devices are failed. And my experience, too, that a lot of times you can catch the failure automatically, so you don't have to do a mock fail.
Right.
He was just telling me, in his specifically documented, continually failing your device, so I was on my screen. So I took reference
to it. I have a comment and all about question, mostly advice. Few different customers who was creating RAID 5 arrays. I was testing it out, pulling the drive out. I was using it to the UIDs in the MD console. So I pull it out there, my log, fill a shelf, way to plug it back in. Before I had the console, it was usable. I used, oh, you were part of the RAID before. I'll add you back in. Oh, crap. Here's the other, from another RAID device. I think it's really confused. But the next block in is already from a previous RAID I had before. In the same system. So I told you the UID files, UIDs inside the COM file to say, I really mean this drive, only that drive, regardless of what people want, he can tell you.
Right.
Who is probably it, other than that, I wanted to question everybody. We were thinking just going RAID 5 and pulling drives, put one shelf, put them back in later, and then we can choose later.
I have a great recommendation.
Well, maybe digital magnets, you know, plug it into another machine and wipe the super blocks.
This is the time creating a client because people are trying to pull drives out. There's only a shelf, assume they're reusable drives, so they can put something in later. Maybe they're using a different.
That's pretty wicked. You shove a drive in there and it says, oh, I've seen you before.
So
in the back? I don't know. Is there a utility to blink the light on a drive? I know there is for, you know, Ethernet devices. I've never done that for a... Never done it for...
There is an indicator utility, but it doesn't necessarily drive.
I guess you could do DD out file equals, you know, the drive you just failed. Just a status light of some sort. Right.
That's an advantage of the hardware. RAID cards, usually they have some utility with them that will actually blink an indicator light so you can figure out which drive
right.
You're actually dealing with.
Okay, so I've probably learned as much about RAID as I've presented tonight, so that was pretty cool. So next, maybe I can learn a little bit about LVM. Yeah? You'll have to ask the guy who wrote the thing in 2005. Yeah, that's my guess. Nice. So moving on, at least I've had a little bit more experience with Logical Volume Manager. In fact, after learning how LVM works, I actually put that on all my machines, even, you know, laptop here, because it's really nice, a really nice way to just grab a chunk of disk and use it for a little while, and when you're done with it, you just throw it away, and you really don't care about where it physically relies, where it physically resides on the disk, and you don't bother with, oh, I got to go run FDisk again and figure out how many chunks I'm going to divide it up in. It's just disk, and it's really nice. So one of the other things that's really nice is you can, while a machine is running, you can move stuff from one disk to another. And I've done that in the past. Plug a USB drive in a machine, tell it to go move everything over to the USB drive while I'm using it, and when it eventually gets all there, then I can do something, you know, FDisk or change some partition size or blow away windows or whatever I was going to do on the original one. Then when I'm done, migrate everything all the way back, and I've never shut down the machine. I'm still, you know, still using it as I was the whole day. So I'll give you some practical examples here. Here's a really good picture that kind of describes what's going on. You can have two physical disks or however many you want to. In my case, I've got one in the laptop. But you group them together in what they call a volume group. And then in that volume group, you slice off little bits of that into logical volumes. So the only purpose of the volume group is to sort of consolidate things, to say I've got this many disks, and I've got this many volumes, and I'm just going to spread all that stuff around among, you know, wherever it all fits. That's true. One of the neat things about this device mapper stuff is you can stack things on top of each other. And the way I've actually done it on this laptop here, I've got a very small flash boot, which is a SDA1, and then SDA2 is the rest of the drive, and I've got that set up as an encrypted Lux device. So on top of the Lux device, I've got LVM, and so slash root and home and anything else I have, you know, I have like slash music or whatever for, you know, my MP3 collection. Well, I go rip a bunch of new CDs and that starts to get full. I just take this one and expand it a little bit, and LVM just handles where the data actually resides. So you can stack all this stuff up. The disk is encrypted. On top of that is LVM. And you could have RAID if you had multiple drives in your machine. So all of the LVM commands come in three different layers, and it's all physical volume group and logical volume. So everything is either PV something, VG something, or LV something. And probably the easiest way to get started with a machine, if you're sitting down to it and you know it's got LVM on it and you want to see what's there, is use PV scan, and it will show the physical devices. Similarly, there's a VG scan and an LV scan, and that's the best way to see kind of what's going on here, although there's some nice graphical tools that will also show you that information as well. I've got some pictures. But it's pretty easy if you want to create physical volumes. In my case, I wanted to create a physical volume off the second partition of the physical drive, so it's SDA2. So you just do PV create slash dev SDA2, and bingo, it's a physical volume available to be added to a volume group.
You can do that with any block device.
Any block device. So that's why I'm doing it on a read-write block device. So if you wanted to, you could have, you know, a whole bunch of thumb drives sticking out of the back of your machine. You know, whatever you've got. I've actually done this on a battery-backed memory device, which we used in the oven. So I didn't get many strange looks when I said we used it in our oven. I usually do.
Isn't this the default for Fedora?
I don't know what the default for Fedora is. I think it's a great option for a laptop. So now, you know, if I lose my laptop or get stolen or something, I really don't worry about the data on it because the whole drive, other than flash boot, the whole drive is encrypted. And so that, along with a reasonable backup strategy, makes a pretty good way to not worry about theft or loss. But you have to have those two together. So we want to create a volume group. Some people like to create multiple volume groups. I know at Techlec we do that. We have one for our Linux platform and then a second one for whatever application is going to reside on that. I don't know, I haven't really had a need to do that myself. On machines that I run, I usually just have one volume group, and I usually just call it, you know, VG1 or something like that. But you basically use VG create, you give it a name, and then you give it a list of devices that have already been created as physical volumes.
That decision about one volume group or multiples is going to be about consideration of the physical devices involved, because you can't have... Well, I guess you can, but ideally you're going to have one volume group is going to be comprised of these three physical devices, and this other one is going to be these three.
Right.
And if you're concerned about, like, where your database index is versus the actual data and how much competition you're having for seeks, that'll matter. Or which ones you want to be on the hotspot.
Right.
You want to know that your main operating
system. So you could, even on something like this, I could have volume group one is the disk that's in the device itself, and volume group two could be all of my USB drives that I plug in that I, you know, pull together. That's a very good example.
Yeah. To recommend using a more descriptive volume group name.
Well, when you have one.
I used to just use the VG name, but then I ran into trouble later when I wanted to take the disk from one machine, put it on another machine that was also using LVM,
right,
also had a volume group named VG.
In fact, usually I'll end up naming my volume groups VG and then followed by the name of the machine it's on, if it's just for that machine. But yeah, I run into that same thing. You pull it out and you go, wait a minute, it's already got the name VG1 on it. So.
Yeah, which was the point I was going to make. However, if you're just driving down the street with default Fedora or Ubuntu installed, they use Vol Group 1 as their default name. So,
yeah, I believe that's what I'm using on here, although to install this on Ubuntu, you have to have the alternate installer. You can't use the normal live CD for the normal desktop live CD. So, you can do it, but you have to install apt-get install LVM while it's running in live mode and then do all the formatting. It's a lot easier just to use the alternate installer. It has a nice little menu. And you can rename them. You can do a VG rename. So boot with a live CD. Do all your work then. Right. So. One other thing that I like to do, and maybe this is just one of my quirks, I like to call my volume group VG something, and the reason why I do that is because that will end up as a directory in the dev directory. So I'm one of these guys that types the first two letters of something and then hit tab. So I'll say /dev/VG tab, and that'll at least show me a list of the volume groups that I have. If you've named them, you know, who knows what, it might be harder to find, like if you named them Trilog. But this was an example that I was actually typing as I was putting together the slides. So this is kind of interesting. So when I did a VG scan, it says, I'm reading all the physical volumes, found volume group trilog. Well, that wasn't really helpful. I'd like to know a little bit more about the volume group. So while I usually like to say PV scan, VG scan, LV scan, I'll actually make an exception to that and say, for the volume groups, do a VG display because it shows you the stuff you want to know, which is mainly how much room have I got and how much is free.
Or, of course, based on LF, EDS, VGS, and LDS.
Ah, I'll have to try those, but not here. I'm not doing a live demo. There's a lot of room for this stuff to blow up, I'm sure. But I use this quite a bit to basically come down here and say, this is a 2 gigabyte volume group, and I'm using 510 meg of the 2 gig is free. Yeah, so it shows you allocated and free. Oh, that's 510 physical extents, and 1.9 gig is free. That's what it's showing you. Right, because I did this right after I created that volume group. And then on the last layer, when you want to slice off a chunk of disk and give it to yourself, you just LV create, you give it the name of the volume group, you say name and size, and boom, you've got a logical volume. In this case, I'll call it music. It'll create it, dev trilog music. It'll tell you how big it is. And from there, you can make a file system on top of it or whatever you want to do. I've used stuff like this a lot. Like, I'll go to my parents' house, and mom says, you know, I want you to back up my pictures or whatever. I go, okay, create a volume group, call it mom. She needs 50 gig or whatever. Copy all the junk onto it. You know, when I get home, I may copy it off to some other place. And then when I'm done, I just delete the volume because I don't need that anymore. It's just sort of a temporary place. I just need a chunk of disk, put a file system on it, and then when you're done, it's gone. Maybe that's one of my little quirks, but I think LVM's really good for that sort of thing. She does, actually. So my dad's got this old junker of a PC, and it runs Windows XP. And it's one of these where you turn it on, and then you go fix breakfast, and when you come back, it might be finished booting. And so mom got a laptop when, you know, she got tired of waiting for that thing. So she got a laptop, and she was going, how can I keep my computer from getting real slow and getting all that crap on it that Dad's computer has on it? I said, well, you can do what I do. She goes, okay. I'm kind of going, really? So I wasn't sure she was real serious about this, so I did the old slice it in half, dual boot, XP on one side, and she hasn't booted the XP partition since the day I installed it, so I consider that a good success. So she runs Ubuntu. Although every time I come home, every time I go to their house, I have to show her how to put the card from the camera in the side to copy the pictures onto there and then take it back out. But that seems to be the only recurring technical thing we have to deal with.
You really should remind us of this in May when it's steering committee elections. My mom runs Linux.
That's right. My mom runs Linux. So I tried to install Linux on Dad's PC, and he got really mad because Excel and OpenOffice didn't look the same. They were slightly different, and he just went ballistic on it. And he said, can you make it back like it was? And so, okay, just restored everything like it was. Now it's just as slow as it always was. So.
Of course, you've been always on Wine and on the Senate's
office as well. Okay, so now I'm going to go off on a really wild tangent. So my wife went on this business trip. She was gone for a week. And while she was gone, I bought her a new laptop. And this was back in the Windows 98 days, back when we were still afraid to switch to XP. And some of us are still afraid to use it. But anyway, I bought her a new laptop, and I put Linux on it and put VMware on there and copied verbatim disk, you know, every file from her old junky laptop to the new VM, and then just sat it on her desk. And when she came home, she said, this computer looks a little different. And I said, well, yeah, but it comes with one rule. It's got to boot Linux. You can do whatever you want to inside VMware, but it's got to boot Linux. So that's a great way to switch somebody against their will. You know, you give them a new computer and say, well, eventually they'll work their way outside of the box. You know, they're stuck in the little VM there, and they'll work their way outside, start running the browser outside, and then they're sold. But anyway, so now that you've got this logical volume disk created, you just treat it like any other disk. Here we're doing a make file system, mount the disk. It's pretty easy. So the really neat part is being able to move stuff around. So depending on your hardware that you've got, you could actually swap out a drive, you know, while it's running. Maybe you don't want to miss a day of work while it's doing all this copying and stuff. So you plug a USB drive in. You tell it to just migrate all your files over, you know, from here to here. You're still using it. You just notice the disk light's blinking a lot. When the thing finally says it's done copying from one disk to the other, or moving files from one disk to the other, you take this one and unplug it, and you take your new 2-terabyte drive or whatever, and you plug it in its place, and then say, okay, now copy it all back. And you've never really lost any time. You've been, you know, working the whole time. So you use this PV move command to move stuff to basically say get off of this drive. Whatever you're doing, whatever you got stored, make sure it's not on this drive. And you've got this VG extend and VG reduce and VG resize to just change the sizes of different. I guess VG extend and VG reduce to add and delete physical volumes from a volume group.
Group one read only part of the CD
No. When you do a PV move, what it does is it marks this device as, from an LVM perspective, it marks it as read-only. It won't write any new extents there. What it'll do is it'll copy everything it has from there onto one of the other drives, and then you can do your PV display to tell you how much is being used. And it'll tell you when PV move will come back and tell you when it's done. I think it gives you a percentage thing every few seconds. It'll tell you how much it's done. So once you've said to move off of it, it's not going to start putting stuff on there, I believe, until everything is filled up on all the other drives. You're sort of marking, quarantining it, marking it as is not desirable to write to. So PV move says, I've got my example here. I had a 2 gig. This is my 2 gig, two loop devices, 1 gig here, 1 gig here. I've only got, you know, maybe 500 meg of actual stuff on it, but they may be spread across the two, you know, however they may have fell. So you're basically just saying anything that was written over here, just write it over there and make sure. It's almost like doing the, what's the thing the DOS people used to always do that would, there you go. It's like defragging and saying, put all my stuff on this side and leave that side free. But it is. Right. And then when you VG reduce, you're actually saying, okay, now take this out of the volume group because I'm going to unplug it. That's true. Yeah, but don't count on it being there because it's marked those things as not as available extents. Sure. But that's like saying there's data on the unused portion of your drive that was whatever was there before. It's my mom's pictures that's on that unused, because that's that 50 gig partition that I made a little while back. So practical example, so this is basically running you exactly through what I just said before about replacing a hard drive live while a machine's running. Kind of crazy stuff, but it's sort of the step-by-step that you would do. I have done this before. I actually wanted to change the physical partitions of a drive while I was using it, and it was the case where I'm at work, and all I have to do is just start one of these moves going, and I can wait all day, because as long as it's not really interfering with what I'm doing, it's, you know, as long as the machine's up, we're good. So you just tell it to move, and then when you're done, you F-disk to get it laid out the way you want it to, and then you tell it to move back. Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. So this is the really cool part. We'll talk about snapshots. So a snapshot is one of these things that's kind of backwards to think about. So I'll give you a really good example. We went into the data center where Pilot is, where our trilog.org is hosted, and I wanted to make a backup of the root file system, but we're using it. And I really didn't want to just, you know, start a backup going, and you get, you know, at the beginning of the backup, you'd get some early files, and towards the end of the backup, you got late files. And if you ever restored the backup, it wouldn't even make any sense because, you know, there would have been changes in between the beginning and the end. And so the whole thing is not really consistent internally among, you know, with itself, if that makes any sense. So, you know, because a backup of this size can take some time. So what I really wanted to do is I wanted to say right now, is when I want to make my backup. Now, it may take forever to actually do that. So what you do is you make a snapshot volume. And it's kind of weird because, you know, we'll just say, for example, I've got a 100 gig partition that I want to make a snapshot of. But I really don't need 100 gig of disk space for the snapshot. All I really need is maybe, we'll say 2 gig, because that's how much I expect to be written and read and overwritten during the amount of time that I'm using it. Does that make a lot of sense there? You know, there's not a lot of churn There's just a few of the files are going to be rewritten and everything. So what happens is LVM creates, in this case I said it was 100 meg, but in my example I'll say it creates a 2 gig snapshot partition that basically says, I've got a list of diffs here that can be up to 2 gig long, and anything else that's not in this list comes from the other place. So the snapshot is going to look like whatever it was at the instant you created it. So somebody goes and writes some file to the root file system on Pilot, and what happens is LVM goes and reads the block from the root file system and puts it in my list of diffs. And then it takes the new data and writes it to the root file system. That's called copy on write, because every time it writes to the root file system, it copies the old block into my little list of diffs that I'm keeping. And the end result is, if I go look at slash dev vg1 root, which is our actual root file system, I'll see the up-to-date files. If I look at dev vg1 root snap, I'm going to see whatever it looked like when I first created the snapshot. It's pretty clever the way it works, and it's really efficient because it doesn't really use up a whole lot of space. One thing that people do with this is they'll create virtual machines. So maybe you've got one server that has 10 virtual machines, and they're all the same thing. So what you do is you create one base file system, and then help me on this. You create 10 snapshots of this, and each VM looks at the snapshot.
Yeah, they mount the snapshot off the original.
Right. So in this case, it kind of works the other way around. The diffs are being stored in that snapshot file, and that's the one they mount and they write to. And it's sort of the inverse of the example that I gave you about backing up the root file system. In this case, you're writing to the snapshot. That's true. When it fills up, it LVM fails in some sort of way. It says I/O error, you can't write to this device anymore because I don't have any place to put it.
So LVM does block level copy on write. Many of you might actually be tangentially familiar with copy on write from live CDs. Most live CDs use UnionFS, some use AUFS, and that's a file system copy on write, where it doesn't care about the blocks, it cares about the files and the contents of them.
Right.
And this is way more powerful because then you can actually have these be physical extents inside some other LVM something.
And actually, some of those files, those processes have not made it upstream, they're all compacted, so the LVM block level snapshot is using them.
Another thing annoying about AUFS, if you do anything to your files, when you change your permissions, they'll copy the whole file over. So just do like a chmod 7755 and hold directory and copy everything.
Wow.
Annoying.
That's rude.
Because the live CDs usually use a RAM disk for the copy on write portion.
Right.
You can actually do that with LVM too. So you could make a RAM disk and have that be one of your specific systems.
Okay. Yep. You can make your snapshot larger than it was originally. Sweet. The reason why I don't, because this is an LVM talk and not a virtual machine talk. So we're just trying to show that there are a lot of uses for snapshots on LVM. It's a very nice facility. The only thing that's really special is you just did the dash S, or I think you can do minus minus snapshot just to tell it that that's the type of device it's going to be. It's just a copy on write and not a full volume of its own. So when you do an LV scan, you'll see it'll actually say active original, active snapshot, and it'll show the two as if, right next to each other. So the example that I chose here is if I want to do a DD of whatever slash dev trilog snap out file to a tape, the tape may take forever. So there's a good example of something you may want to do.
I think you have to specify the original logical volume after the dash test from the LV3.
Yes, you do. Yeah. Obviously, I cut and pasted some of this. So. Somewhere in somewhere along, you have to actually say, oh, no, that's what it is. This is the original. The original was music, and the new one is called snap. So here's music, here's snap. The original is specified here on the command line. So you say LV create, the name of the original. It is a snapshot. The new one's going to be called name snap. The new size is going to be 100 meg.
I think the dash S has
been earlier. I think this was actually from Bash. That's where I got all this text from. So. That's right. So this is really neat. I discovered in the process. So if you want to see what this looks like without running PVScan, VGScan, and LVScan, you can run this thing system-config-lvm as a package. At least that's the Ubuntu Debian name of the package. It has this nice little utility here, which shows, and I don't know if you can see it from back there, but there's a line on this nice 640 by 480 display that we got. There's a line right here, and it says loop 1 here, loop 2 is here, and then it shows this much of it is music, and this much of it is unused space. So it gives you a really good idea of how everything's laid out, but what you should not misconstrue here is you shouldn't think that means music is written all on loop 1 and a little bit on loop 2, because you really don't know where it is. This has all been chopped and sliced and diced and put wherever LVM felt like putting it at the time. So if you want to have finer control over that, then maybe LVM's not the tool you want to use, or maybe you need to be using PVMove to move stuff, you know, from one to another. I'm not sure. To spread things out for you? But is that part of LVM or is that a... Yeah. Right. Right. Because it's not necessarily guaranteed to stay there. It may move, or it may, you know, if you rewrite files, it may write the new blocks on the other drive and delete the old blocks. You know, if you've got a file system mounted on it, you're copying stuff around and you're doing whatever it is you do and you remix your music and you write a new file and all that. It may put the new file on a new place and the old file there. You're just telling where you wanted it to begin with.
If you can actually find the sound of the logical volume and starting at extent X to extent X plus X on whatever.
Boy, that's really, really messed up. To me, I would think that if you need that fine-grained control, you need to be setting up a volume group for it. But, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I have a final slide on here that does say, be careful with all of this stuff. These are loaded guns. So there's a couple of commands you want to use to clean up, LV remove, EG remove, PV remove, in that order. And then, so the last thing I'll talk about is Lux. So Lux is an on-disk standard for how to define a partition layout with passwords, where the partitions are encrypted. So it's a standard that defines what's on the disk. There are implementations for Linux, and there are implementations for other OSs as well. And I think somewhere in here I mentioned other places that use Lux. So there's a couple of different commands to use. There's a crypt setup command that you can use to format and open. There's also you can tell it to format all at once, or you can be a little bit more granular about it where you say open it and then format it with whatever formatting tool that you want, and then you can use the crypt setup again to close. And then Lux format also has some, there's a Lux format command all by itself where it takes a couple of command line arguments. But basically they're all just wrappers around this crypt setup command. So here's examples of how to mount a partition. There's another wrapper called pmount, which will do the same thing. And in fact, I've noticed here, well, you don't see this, I have the little the disk mapper, is that what they call it? The little thing that shows you when you plug in a USB drive, it shows up on your desktop down here. So one of the devices I have on here, if I just click on it and say mount, the first thing that pops up is this right here. So it's integrated into the GNOME desktop. So it just says, this requires a password, and you can tell it to remember it or forget it. So that's kind of nice that it's all integrated for you. So I believe it was integrated in KDE before it was in GNOME. So what's nice is you can Lux format a thumb drive. You stick the thing in, this window pops up. So it makes it real easy. Oh boy, this is hard to do. And unmounting is pretty much the same thing. You've got PU mount, or you can unmount it and then call crypt setup to close. And I guess one of the other things, at least the Ubuntu installer, if you set it up so that it boots like this, it'll do all this stuff, all this magic behind the scenes. When I boot my machine, I see the normal little logo and all that stuff, and then it very early in the process, right after it loads the kernel and the initial RAM disk, I get a little window that opens up that says, I need a password for this disk. And it gives me the UUID of the disk, and I'm just supposed to type in the password. And then as soon as I do that, it continues on with the normal boot process that you're used to. So they've even made it so boot up is kind of nice and pretty for you. So if you look, I didn't output what it says when you actually do a Lux dump over here. But if you use this crypt setup command, there's a couple of Lux dump, or show me the UUID of Lux devices, or a simple yes, no, is Lux command. The Lux dump command will show you there are 8 slots for passwords, which seems kind of freaky. So what they do is they actually encrypt the disk using one master password, and then there are 8 user passwords that you use to get the master password. I'm not really sure why you would want to do that, but if you'd want to have a disk that had 2 different passwords, maybe you had 2 different users and say, you use password 1, you use password 2. All right, example.
Let's say you've got a company full of laptops that have encrypted hard drives on them, and the user forgets their password.
There we go. Administrator password and user password. So that way 2 people can have access to it, even if he forgets. Right. You could have the key could actually be a key file instead of a password that's entered, but it's really cool. So in fact, I have forgotten the password that I first set up on this drive, but I have a second one that I used because once I realized it was Lux and I could put 8 passwords on it, I filled in some of the other blanks. So I would have been a little bit more careful to remember it if I didn't have to, you know, have that little fallback there. But anyway, that's why we have the 8 user keys. And then if you want to change a password, you use the same crypt setup command. They've got a Lux add key and a Lux delete key, so you can add one to the list and delete one out of the list. The hard part is figuring out which one's which. There is a way, and I forget what it is, where you can use one of these crypt setup commands where when you type one of the passwords, it'll say, yeah, that was the one for slot 3. And then you go, okay, now delete the one that's in slot 3. And I guess in the case of the forgotten password, it'll be the one that you weren't able to to activate. So just some closing thoughts here. Sometimes when you got a system set up like this, it can be kind of hard to figure out how to recover from it. And in fact, when our machine in the data center pilot went down, that's what I did. I went in there with a live CD and just sort of scratched my head and tried to figure out, well, I wonder what's on this drive. I figure it's probably got RAID and all this stuff on it. So you can boot a normal live CD, especially a modern distribution like Ubuntu, and after you've got it booted up, if it doesn't have NVADM or LVM2 installed, those packages installed, you can just install it, you know, into RAM. You have to get installed, and it'll put it in there. And if you did the live USB stick creator, it's smart enough that next time when you boot it up, those packages that it downloaded will still be stored not in RAM, but actually on the flash drive itself. So that's a real nice kind of utility to be able to set up just enough to boot a system with the NVADM package and the LVM2 package and crypt set up and pmount. So that should be enough to get into a system that maybe for whatever reason it's not booting properly or whatever. And then you can set up, go through all the steps that we did before to say, all right, reconstruct this RAID array or whatever you need to do. Be careful. That's the big thing. That's why I wanted to show you about playing around with the loop devices, because it's very easy to get yourself in hot water when you're playing with things like my file system spread across 5 disks now. Any one of the disks gets messed up, hey, guess what? You know, my file system doesn't make sense anymore. I can't even access any of it. So learn the tools using something innocuous like these little loop files. And then once you feel real comfortable with it, then put it on an actual disk. And I think before we mentioned something about removing the LO setup, you can do the -D to get rid of those little devices that are hanging around. And that's it.
Is there a way to back up just the key portion of the Lux partition?
I don't know, but I bet Lux dump probably has an option.
Well, look at the main pages now. It says loop, Lux head of backup. So I presume that's the head of backup.
Yeah, because that's what it is. It stores it in the first, it's like in the first sector or two, all of the information about the passwords.
DM crypt with a standardized layout that always keeps your key on the same drive as the encrypted data.
Right? Yes, that's exactly right. I think it only supports files, just a file and a typed-in passphrase.
You could probably make something like that work with EMCrypt.
Yeah.
Are they saying he is like a known passive manager? So he's just showing the dialogue. That looks like he's the one known passive manager, so I can use that.
Well, the password manager is just letting you type in your passphrase and then storing it there. Is that similar to what the Java thing does?
No. Yeah.
So that would be more of a key that would be stored in the...
Is that why key is always like a database with all the username passwords and stuff like that? Username and key? Well, actually, you can find out what kind of key is. Well, I'm just doing it. You can find a key alias.
Okay. It's an exercise for the reader.
I just want to say something about the setup or whatever you do. Encryption is you should write random data to your drive beforehand.
Or afterwards. You could actually, that was one thing I wanted to mention. So my computer came with stuff on it. The first thing I did when it came out of the box was I put a live CD in there and did all my setup and everything. Well, that stuff was still there because I haven't written to the whole drive. So one thing I could do is after I've got the thing set up, I just create a really big file. I just let DD just fill up something with all zeros. But underneath, what's going to happen is it's going to write random data that represents those zeros to the entire physical disk. And then when I'm done, I just remove that, you know, remove that that one file full of zeros. And you know, that's so that's sort of the lazy way, where after you've set it up, you go, oh yeah, I meant to scrub that disk. Sure. To make sure that the disk itself doesn't have whatever used to be on it, a good way to cover up all the stuff that used to be on it. I'm not really concerned about anybody stealing my laptop and getting a copy of Dell's junk that they put on there, which is a lot of junk.
Well,
but
I'm not concerned with that, but they
right.
say that if you don't do that, then it's easier to break into your encrypted partition.
Yeah.
But granted, while you're storing up this stuff, that actually needs that.
Well, I'm also not worried about the NSA stealing my laptop, but I don't like the idea of, you know, the thing of me having to worry about every single file I put on there and all that kind of stuff. I have met Julian Assange, by the way. Last year I met him at Hack in the Box. He was a keynote speaker. So I guess if we don't have any further questions, how about this? We'll take further questions as we mingle. Sure. I will post that somewhere and a link to it on the mailing list. We will have Tri-Chug afterwards at Bada Wings.
The bar at
Bada Wings. And do we have a special request from our host here about how to arrange the furniture?
Yeah, we just asked folks to put the chairs over against the wall on one side and the tables over here. And we'll have a bar and some food and some people to watch.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot for coming.
I'm a little bit late to this announcement for you in the meeting. I don't know if you're aware of it, but any of you that are into practicing you know, learning from electronics and actual hardware and soldering and stuff, I'd say to be hosting a Learn to Pattern Lab on a week Saturday. It's open to all of you.
This is also going to ask the furniture up and glad to care because it was a team and the tables all set up.
Yeah.
They love it, the FDI.
FDI.